This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with our own Michael Ratner about a recent victory of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
They've got a new model of bringing relief to the most oppressed workers in this country.
We'll also talk about the 100th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Haiti.
A black slave revolt in the 18th century that still throws fear in the rulers of this country.
We'll speak with activist Ali Issa from War Resisters League about his recent book, Against All Odds.
What's going on in Iraq now is something Americans know very little about.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, we have had a recent victory with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. What happened?
Yes, it's extraordinary, a major victory. Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW, and the place where my son and his partner worked, called the Alliance for Fair Food, is the support organization, and he's been working on this campaign, of course, with hundreds or thousands of farm workers for a long time. And the victory that they announced on last Tuesday is against the supermarket chain called Ahold, A-H-O-L-D. Most people probably haven't heard of it. It's a Dutch corporation, but it owns Giant, Stop and Shop, Martin's, Peapod. It means that the Fair Food Program will now apply to 780 supermarkets, and that some 50 million people a month, if they buy tomatoes, will be buying Fair Food tomatoes. So it's an absolute major victory. As our listeners may know, CIW has been organizing for some 20 years. The last 5 years have really taken off. They organize farm workers in the Florida tomato fields, which between November and May produce some 90% of the tomatoes in the United States. They had won before this against almost every single one of the fast food companies, McDonald's, et cetera. The one they haven't won against, and they're still waiting to win, and I think they will, is Wendy's. They still have big campaigns against Kroger and Publix, but Ahold is one of the five biggest supermarket chains in the United States. And what it means is that they have agreed to join what's called the Fair Food Program. And that's just not just a set of principles and voluntary, et cetera. What it means is they bound themselves in a legal agreement to buy tomatoes only from farmers who are involved in the Fair Food Program. And what it means is that they will pay a premium for the tomatoes that was advertised for a long time as a penny a pound. They will allow monitoring of the picking of the tomatoes in their fields, which means that any worker can call the Fair Food Program and get someone out there to deal with any kinds of disputes. If there's a problem, that farm can be dropped from the program and will lose a lot of its tomato selling. In fact, in some cases, a majority. It also allows the Fair Food people to go on to the actual farm and train workers in their rights. So it's an extraordinarily important victory. It's particularly important because it's the first of the major supermarkets, of which there are five. And in addition, Ahold has agreed to support the Fair Food Program, which obviously has to pay for monitors, enforcement, et cetera, to support it with $100,000 a year in enforcement. So it's a really, really important victory. It comes on the back, as people may know, of a victory that's related, although not directly CIW, which was the Vermont Dairy Workers Agreement with Ben and Jerry's to have similar kinds of monitoring on dairy farms for people who essentially take care of cows, milk them, et cetera, modeled again on the CIW Fair Food model.
Michael, so, I have a question. What was it that turned this victory around? Was it negotiations? Did something happen to make Ahold change their mind?
Well, you know, where Jake works and others is the Alliance for Fair Food, and what they do is they basically track these companies with demonstrations. Jake, when he first went to Immokalee, and his partner, I believe, their first demonstration they organized was in Boston, and it was in protest of Ahold. That's over 4 years ago. So these are long, hard, difficult struggles. They go to the companies, They go to their doors. They go to college campuses to recruit people, et cetera. And, of course, the main participation is by farm workers themselves, who are out at all these demonstrations, who do all the public speaking, who do all the real organizing of other farm workers. So it's been a lot. It's been really farm workers and their allies, which include the Alliance for Fair Food.
And but, to underscore, this is across the nation. It's not just in Florida.
In this case, Ahold owns supermarkets primarily in the Northeast. So it applies to all their supermarkets, but anywhere they buy tomatoes, yes. If they buy tomatoes outside of Florida, which I'm not sure they do, but if they did, it would apply to them as well. And so now their next big targets, as I said, are Kroger, who I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of, and Publix, which is primarily in Florida and the Southeast, which is, to be honest, has been recalcitrant on this issue, and it's quite shocking.
Well, it's a right-wing, family-owned corporation that says we're not going to let anybody tell us what to do. Meanwhile, the conditions of those farm workers has been changed radically. Michael, tell us about what things used to be like before the CIW got involved.
Well, when CIW started getting involved, one of the things they noticed was actual slavery, and they went after it. And they eventually got the Department of Justice to go after it. But scores of people locked in trucks sometimes, never let out except to pick. And, of course, they're controlled completely by the farm they were working on, because if the farm says, get out of here, get out of here. So that was one problem. The second was beatings in the field. And there's a famous picture of one of the early organizers having blood all over him because of a farm worker who had been beaten. A third thing that happened was a huge amount of sexual abuse in the fields. I'm not saying it's eliminated, but if it happens, you can call CIW or call the farm, farm workers and the Fair Food Program, and they will send an investigator out there immediately. And so it's coming to a close, if not a close. And the last thing was, of course, complete underpayment. They were making nothing for a bucket of tomatoes, very little. The farm workers insisted on a penny more a pound. It doesn't sound like much more, but it may have increased wages from equivalent of $10,000 for 9 months, they pick, or $8,000, to $15,000. It was a lot. And the reason for that was, in part, they increased the price. But also what happened is the way it works is you go out in the field and you fill your bucket. I'm sure people have seen these red buckets that are filled. And then when you take the bucket, which weighs quite a bit, and you pour it into the truck, you get a little metal counter. And that metal counter, at the end of the day, you turn in, and that's how you get paid for the number of buckets you picked. Well, what would happen is the foreman on the truck, or the people running that truck system, would insist that people put more tomatoes into the bucket than are allowed. They would make a little pile of tomatoes on top of the bucket, and then people were not paid for that. They were only paid for what the normal bucket could hold. So they were cheated in every way you could make up. And, you know, in some way, what's amazing about this organizing, and it's just, of course, me speaking and not the farm workers and not the organizers, but what I understood, the original model that CIW did was to go after the farmers themselves. But the farmers themselves, who own large farms in Florida, were squeezed between the big markets, like Ahold and others, as well as the fast food companies, and then people on the ground, like the Immokalee workers. And they were squeezed, the Immokalee workers demanding better wages and conditions, the big supermarkets, et cetera, saying to the farms, if you raise the cost to us, we're going to go somewhere else. We'll buy Mexican tomatoes, we'll do something else. So for a long time, they tried to organize to get the farms to do better. But I think they realized that wasn't working because the farms themselves were so squeezed. The genius strategy came out to be going after the big markets, going after the fast food chains, et cetera, who said, well, it's not us, go after the farmers. But in the end, it proved their organizing strategy worked. Going after supermarkets, going after the fast food chains, et cetera, was what eventually brought this industry into an entirely different place. And of course, as we may have announced or talked about a few weeks ago on the show or a few months ago, Walmart actually settled with them, which is extraordinary. Walmart controls 16% of the industry, of the food industry in the United States. And now there will be some efforts, apparently, to expand this to other crops as well. It'll be interesting to see how fast it can grow, but it's absolutely major. And, you know, one interesting thing when we talk about this, I often talk about, is this a union or not a union? In fact, it's not a union. As most people may not be aware, farm workers, other than in California, can't form unions. They can't form unions under the National Labor Relations Act, and most states, except for California, don't allow them to form unions. So this is not done with a union model. It's done with a direct action model. It's done by forcing the markets to sign these agreements. And what's interesting about that, it's not like there's an election every year or every 2 years and you can toss out one union and be yellow-dogged into another union. These are permanent agreements with supermarkets. And so forever, there'll be a monitoring system, a protection system, and a way to get people much, much better conditions of picking tomatoes.
Michael, this is a wonderful victory. I just have a quick question. Are you saying that since this applies only to tomatoes, that, for example, strawberry pickers or orange pickers, are they subject to the same horrific conditions?
The answer, Heidi, unfortunately, is yes. Strawberry pickers, I think, are particularly bad. I think others as well. And so what's not what now people are looking at, I think, at CIW and other places, is expanding the program to include other crops, strawberries being a very big crop in Florida in particular. But even the tomato agreement now applies in other states because there's farms up in Georgia, you know, just north of Florida, et cetera. So exactly, the conditions are horrendous in our agricultural industry.
Well, congratulations to Jake and his colleagues, and thanks for the update.
And particularly to the, as they always emphasize,
yes,
to the workers,
workers
who have been in this struggle
of course.
Forever.
Michael, switching countries for a moment, there's an important 100th anniversary with respect to Haiti that we celebrated last week. Let's talk about that.
Well, July 28th, 1915, and July 28th, 2015, makes the 100th anniversary of the U.S. occupation of Haiti. It's the 100th anniversary, and it was an occupation that literally lasted for 19 years and was done as openly, it was said by President
Wilson.
He actually said this is to protect U.S. and foreign interests, and of course to protect the sugar industry, which is owned primarily by the United States. But of course, that mark of an intervention, July 28, 1915, we could look at both sides of that, because it's not like U.S. intervention in Haiti started on July 28, 1915, nor did it end the 19 years later. In August 1934. It started way before as the French Revolution occurred. Let's not start with the French Revolution. There was a Haitian slave revolt in 1791, and it went for a number of years. And after the French Revolution, there was much talk about freeing the slaves. After all, this was a revolt of the French Revolution, was liberty, equality, and fraternity. But somehow, despite people like Robespierre and Marat, France was not willing to let go of the colony because it was its richest colony. It was the richest colony in the Americas. Hard to believe when we look at Haiti today. And when you think about the numbers who were in Haiti at that time, 32,000 Frenchmen, 24,000 mixed, and 500,000 slaves. So if you imagine the wealth that France got out of that colony. As the revolt began, Washington and Jefferson supported France and not the Haitians. In 1802, Napoleon went in there to put down the revolt. He couldn't do it. In 1803, the French were defeated. But let me tell you an amazing fact. It wasn't until 1862 that the U.S. recognized the independent country of Haiti. Strike a bell with a reason would be, when is that?
The Civil War is going on.
Right.
Talk about what happened when the Haitian ambassador came to Washington.
Right. Well, first what happened is the U.S. Sugar plantation slave industry was terrified by Haiti, as was all of the industries, all of the sugar cane, all of that in the entire hemisphere, because a slave revolt was what everybody totally feared. You can imagine, 500,000 slaves in Haiti, 32,000 Frenchmen, and their slaves. I mean, can you imagine, how do they keep those people under control? Murderously. And so for that period of time, up until the Civil War, the U.S. wouldn't recognize Haiti, period, because huge fear in the American slave-owning community and its periphery about what had happened and whether we would have a revolt in the United States. But then we have a U.S. Civil War. And at that point, the U.S. needs to have support from Haiti because this is a crucial part of helping to defeat slavery in the South and helping to defeat the South in the Civil War. So at that point, the U.S. apparently asks for the ambassador from Haiti to come and visit the president. And I don't know, I don't recall the exact details, but I remember they forced him to sit for many days in the office, where he was meeting the president, and just let him cool his heels until they actually took him in, talked to him, and were willing to recognize the Haitian Revolution and the Haitian people. So let's go back to 1915. So that's behind 1915. When you go forward from 1915, it doesn't exactly get much better. As I said, the occupation ended in 1934, and at that point, there was a series of presidents in Haiti. Eventually, when many people may remember Duvalier, supported and backed by the United States, then his son, Papa Doc Jr., or whatever he was called.
Baby Doc,
right. And it went on for that. And then finally, those people were forced out or got overthrown. And then Aristide ran for president in 1990, who he eventually became president. You know, liberal left, progressive, church priest. And, you know, I went to Haiti a lot during that period. I knew President Aristide, and I remember sitting in a house. I don't think it was with him. It may have been. I don't remember. But as I said, he ran for president in 1980. The U.S. opposed him. I think that's important to understand. This popular priest, the U.S. opposed him. And it wasn't just the U.S. Jimmy Carter opposed him. What was said to Aristide is, look, you're not really ready to be president of this country. We'd like someone else to be president, and that's Marc Bezin, who is a World Bank guy. And this is Carter talking essentially directly, I understand, to Aristide. Aristide insisted on running for president anyway, despite the U.S. opposition. And guess what the vote was? 67% for Aristide, 14% for the World Bank handpick U.S. person. So again, the U.S. trying to sway what was going to happen in Haitian politics. On September 30th, 1991, Aristide is driven out of Haiti, most likely with the help of U.S. forces in some way. He was eventually, interestingly enough, as things began to deteriorate under Clinton, he was eventually returned to Haiti in 1994. U.S. landed 20,000 troops, and Aristide had 1 year left in his term. They wouldn't give him credit for the 3 years he'd been out. Now, it's interesting about that return of Aristide. I remember hearing about it and talking to people about it. The U.S., as a condition of bringing Aristide back, insisted on having the major industries in Haiti privatized, the cement industry, the telephone industry, others as well. Aristide came back and was president from 2001 to 2004, I presume again against the wishes of the United States. In 2004, there's another coup. Aristide gets forced out and, according to him, kidnapped and put on an airplane out of Haiti. He then is in exile in South Africa until 2011, and then eventually went back to Haiti, but no longer as a politician, but as a writer, an academic, and as a person who believed in charity and taking care of people when he was back. So again, we see before 1915, after 1915, continuous U.S. interference in Haiti.
Well, it's really been a terrible story of what's happened to Haiti, that rich, rich country, which is now can't feed itself, plagued by disease, hit by hurricanes, people with no homes, giant deforestation, mudslides. They've made that place a hellhole. And I think that ultimately the reason for it was a black country.
I think that's right, Michael. Country, it was the first revolution in the Americas. Let's look at it that way. Number one, and it was a black revolution.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine the fear that struck in people? The other interesting thing that you just raised with me is what's happened since then, even as we speak now. Remember, after the hurricane, there was this huge effort, the supposed effort that all these countries got together and we're going to put hundreds of millions, billions of dollars into rebuilding Haiti. And the Clinton Foundation was very, very significant in that,
sure,
pulling together groups of donors, essentially to sell off the country, but groups of donors to give money and rebuild houses. The number is minuscule. Of the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of houses destroyed, I mean, the number rebuilt, is it in the hundreds? It's nothing. So they've done nothing with the aid. They're nothing to really help Haiti. The extent they want to help it, they want to privatize it, bring the World Bank in, and completely demolish the place.
Michael, thank you so much for it was more than an update on this important 100th year anniversary. I just wanted to remind our listeners that the great book written about the Haitian Revolution is by C.L.R. James, called The Black Jacobins. It's been in print for many years. I'd recommend it to everybody. Michael, before we say goodbye to you, do you have any thoughts on the connection between Haiti and it's now a one-year anniversary of a racist situation here in this country, Ferguson? Have any thoughts on that?
Let me make one comment on Black Jacobins, which I think, as you said, Michael, is probably the most brilliant book ever written about Haiti, easily accessible, and goes through that history of what was happening in the Congress, or whatever it was called, in France after the revolution, and how they couldn't bring themselves to actually free Haiti. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing story of the contradictions of these so-called revolutionaries and not being able to free their huge, rich slave colony. Now, drawing the connections to Ferguson, I mean, what can we say, Michael? Is it the same? Sure it is. It's the U.S. basically saying that blacks have no rights, they're not worth anything to us, that we will kill them with impunity. And what did they do with Haiti? What did they do in Ferguson? And, of course, what does Ferguson represent today, as you and I and others have talked about? It represents, of course, the ability to kill blacks with bullets instead of just lynch them. But it also represents, we hope, the beginning of an incredible movement in this country. I remember talking to some friends. I said, this is a moment, as horrible as it is, it's a moment that doesn't happen very often, when millions of people are mobilized to try and end some of the violence against blacks that has been really, it's been the heart of this country, sadly.
Michael, thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you back in New York in a week or two.
Thank you very much, Heidi, and thank you, Michael Smith.
Take it easy, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Long before the U.S. imposed sanctions in Iraq, and long before the brutal and unlawful 2003 invasion, called Operation Iraqi Liberation, the acronym for OIL, our government supported a dictatorship, along with torture and extermination. Individuals engaging in acts of resistance in Iraq faced mass rapes, enslavement, and massacres. Missing from our country's media coverage and political narrative surrounding Iraq are the many courageous stories of progressive Iraqi voices. Activist Ali Issa's recent book, Against All Odds, goes a long way toward filling this void. An organizer with the War Resisters League, he has assembled a rich account of Iraqi organizers and revolutionaries, their analysis, their political works, their visions, their challenges. This important compendium provides much-needed insights into the committed and just-minded individuals who work to rebuild society and social institutions amidst disappearances and assassinations. It's published by Todd Wynn Publishing and the War Resisters League. Ali Issa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Heidi.
Tell us how you came to write Against All Odds.
Sure. Well, I guess one of the beginnings is in 2009. I had recently moved to New York, and I was an interpreter for an Iraqi labor delegation that was here to build connections with the U.S. labor movement. That was one of the first times that I started to become aware of organizing across different movements in Iraq happening then, and how I could use some of my language skills and kind of political curiosity to bring those voices to a much larger audience, since it wasn't just the labor movement in Iraq that people didn't know about, but the women's movement, 2 years later, a very large and important protest movement, So this book is a culmination of many different relationships I built and reports I'd been writing for years, and a way to imagine kind of a different relationship to Iraq and the challenges and potentials that I think they've been trying to get the world to know for a long time now.
Tell us a bit about your own personal background, if you will, just to inform the whole picture.
Sure. So my father is from Baghdad, and he came to the U.S. with his sisters in 1979. So I grew up in a household that was full of the Arabic language. I moved around a lot in mostly kind of smallish towns in Iowa and New Jersey and Oklahoma. So I always had a connection to the Iraqi dialect and culture, but I only visited Iraq once in 1986. And then into the 90s, when the sanctions really started to bite, my remaining relatives in Iraq moved to Jordan. So like a lot of people in the Iraqi diaspora, I visited my family, not in Iraq itself, but where they'd moved to. In that case was in Amman, Jordan's capital, where I went for many summers throughout high school and college. And then finally, when I finished college, I moved to Amman just to spend some time there to learn to read and write, which I was never able to do. And when I came back, I slowly started to kind of become politicized and see a relationship between political work organizing here in the U.S. and then this kind of heritage I've been fortunate to be born into.
Ali, the book Against All Odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq, has interviews, because you don't have to physically, in the modern world, be there to interview somebody. You can do it on Skype, you can do it on the phone, you can do it on the computer, and it has interviews with a lot of people and leaders in Iraq, which is makes the book so extraordinary and so unique. And I wanted to ask you, what topics does the book cover, and what sort of people do you interview? And then let's get into what these people had to say.
Sure. So the book is intentionally very broad, because I tried to give just a real wide cross-section of the different kind of issues and struggles Iraqis have been fighting for. So a good place to begin, I think, is 2011, since inspired by the Arab uprisings in general, Iraqis also had their own protest movement, which grew to be very massive. So, for instance, the shoe thrower's brother, Odaya Zaidi, was a very important leader. And all the other organizations and organizers in the labor movement, in the women's movement, or gender justice, we could say, in the environmental movement, journalists refer to 2011 as a time when there just was seemingly infinite potential to change their conditions. And of course, in Iraq's case, in 2011, the U.S. occupation was still there. Regional influences, especially Iran and the Gulf, were very much in effect. So I think the stories are local, and they're about those local issues, but they're also about how organizing can happen amidst kind of a very multi-pronged attack on Iraqi sovereignty and self-determination.
And I wanted to ask you specifically about the difficulties of progressive voices in Iraq. We read about horrific conditions, enslavements, assassinations, threats. Did a lot of these individuals that you spoke with work under arduous circumstances?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think one of the points of the book, though, is to talk about how there's actually a long legacy of progressive organizing in Iraq, and how, for example, the gender justice or women's movement goes back decades and generations. For my aunt, for example, Fawzia was a big part of an Iraqi women's organization. So, yeah, there is, and especially now with kind of the forces unleashed by ISIS and the horrors there, it's sometimes even hard to understand how these forces can still exist. But I think once you hear directly from them, you begin to see that starting off by framing Iraq as a place full of victims, and that's what to highlight, is really kind of the wrong thing. I think we can talk about the devastation there through what people have been demanding and fighting for, and also even succeeding. So there's particular cases where people have been able to expand, like the women's shelter program or fight against the oil law. And that's kind of the framing that I want to bring about, because it means we can actually work with them directly. I mean, they're still there.
I think the oil law is important, because it really goes to the central reason the United States was interested in overthrowing the government of Iraq and establishing itself there. Could you talk to us about that partial victory in the oil law of 2007?
Sure, yeah. So that's a particular interview with an important writer named Greg Muddett, who wrote a book called Fuel on the Fire, which lays out kind of the political economy and the history of the U.S.'s attempt to not just privatize the Iraq oil, but maintain a certain level of access and kind of regional dominance against other oil producers and competitors in the region. So what happened with the oil law is very connected to something people may be familiar with called the surge, which was the attempt to surge more troops into Iraq and try to achieve strategic objectives, one of which was to basically empower multinational corporations over the Iraqi parliament to make decisions concerning oil. What they didn't necessarily expect, though, was that the Iraqi labor movement had been growing and building since 2003, when they were able to start opposing some of the existing Saddam anti-labor laws that Paul Bremer maintained after the occupation began. And they met in 2006, the Iraqi labor unions, and especially the Oil Federation based in the south, to try to oppose what was an obvious plan to disempower not just the Iraqi labor unions, but actually the entire Iraqi government, which wasn't pushing this deal. So there was kind of a popular campaign to spread awareness of what the oil law would do, and eventually it achieved such momentum that it seeped into the parliament and prevented that law's passing, which meant that at the time, and still technically, the contracts under which Iraq's oil is signed with multinational corporations are not covered by legal sanction. And so that in a future very different circumstance, they can be challenged legally and return some of the sovereignty to the unions and the Iraqi people as a whole.
Against all odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq, quite a wonderful and unique book. We're so pleased to be able to talk.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Against All Odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq, quite a wonderful and unique book. We're so pleased to be able to talk. Switching to another struggle, there's an environmental crisis, enormous proportions in Iraq, and there's a group called Save the Tigris, and I wanted to ask you about your interview with the people involved in that.
Sure. So Nadi al-Baghdadi is a contact I made, again, through the internet through, you know, like one organizer kind of led to another, and that's how I have this cast of characters. So that story begins when she discovers on Facebook that that there's a campaign to save the Tigris and the marshes from the effects of a dam in Turkey, because the Tigris River extends north into Turkey, and a dam project, which Turkey had slated for years, was kind of being rammed through the Iraqi government, which would produce drought, kind of like unimaginable effects, since so much of the natural environment and a lot of Iraqi communities depend on that river. So this is around 2012, 2013. They started to organize across Iraq to pressure the Iraqi government to stop the building of this dam. And what's important about that, too, is that Iraq is often seen as like many, or often three exactly, isolated communities that's divided by sect and ethnicity. But a lot of these particular campaigns cross sect, cross geography, cross language even, so that things like natural resources, of course, affect everyone. And this campaign to save the Tigris and prevent the dam was intentionally targeted towards people in the north, in Baghdad, in the center, and in the south. So though the circumstances now with ISIS and various disasters have made it much harder to maintain the momentum there, that's an existing campaign and one where there's, again, a chance to talk about how organizing in Iraq can overcome the enormous difficulties they're facing.
In fact, Ali, you end that chapter with, I believe this is part of the interview, it says, the effect of the Islamic State is catastrophic in terms of the numbers of lives lost. Refugees were forced out of their homes, had to witness so much violence and death as they escaped. It was a big psychological blow. And it ends with saying, so the effect of the Islamic State is devastating, but there is also a way that it is uniting us. And that seems to be a thread of hope in terms of how you're presenting these various people's movements amidst the conditions there wrought by the U.S. government to such an extent.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's a balancing act because you want to be real about how they are catastrophes. And then second, how it's important to note that because Iraq has been kind of opened up and disempowered, it's not just the U.S. which is able to take advantage of that, but Turkey, for example, how could they push for that dam? Well, it's because they have greater regional influence and Iraq's government is in all kinds of chaos. Iran's role is extremely important, and one of the clearest effects of the U.S. occupation has been to increase Iran's ability to influence all kinds of policies. So, yeah, the hopefulness is just, I think, just the condition of Iraqis surviving, being creative and imagining things, their existing movement history, which they're still building on, but also, the fact that it seems like the only way to imagine a different future is to kind of do it yourself, and a lot of Iraqis have been practicing that principle for years now.
Ali, you're working with the War Resisters League,
yes,
an old and most admirable organization whose belief is that social change comes from below. And I'd like you to kind of make a connection for us between what the War Resisters League does here in the United States and how it sees the struggle going on in Iraq.
Yeah, well, I think, if we want to go back to the pledge of War Resisters League, it's about resisting all war and its root causes, which it talks about as racism, sexism, and all human exploitation. So the attempt by Iraqis to build these movements and relate to one another across them, I think, reflects a lot of WRL's values. More specifically, though, I think when we imagine war making as something that the U.S. is so involved in, it's easy to slip into kind of like hands off Iraq, don't bomb Iran, and focus on what's happening here in the U.S. But WRL actually has a history of like direct contact and support with movements on the ground in these places harmed by the U.S. So going back to the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa or various movements across Asia, so that being against war and its root causes also requires to know what people are doing on the ground and to take leadership from them. So this is hopefully kind of a first attempt to understand what Iraqis really want.
Against All Odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq, quite a wonderful and unique book. We're so pleased to be able to talk to him about the struggle that's going on in Iraq now, something that Americans know very little about. Heidi?
Ali, as you were putting this book together, and I understand you translated most of the interviews for this,
yeah.
Was there one or two particular individuals or stories that really resonated with you?
Sure, yeah. I think one that comes to mind, which was kind of just a chance to get deeper into something I was already familiar with, was an interview with someone named Jannat El-Ghazi, who's the media director for the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. That felt really important because OFI, as it's also known, you know, fights for various things and has, for example, changing patriarchal laws within the Iraqi constitution, but also taking a position against U.S. and regional influence in Iraq. So a really visionary organization, but talking to Jannat was special because she herself had come through some of OFI's shelters after escaping violence in her own family and had, you know, risen through OFI to become one of its most important leaders. So talking to her really demonstrated OFI's vision for how leadership should grow from the people affected by an issue and how their shelters aren't just safe houses to protect Iraqi women, but are, as she puts it, schools where people get to learn about movement history and organizing skills and really kind of take control over the organization and politics there. So she's amazing. Another important interview is with someone named Ahmed Habib, who is a friend that made a website called chokumaku.net. Y'all can check it out. And it was important because it was trying to be a virtual space for the Iraqi diaspora to talk about their, you know, their interest in Iraq, their desire to know what's happening inside, and also to challenge the narrative of Iraq as a hopeless, destroyed place. So, of course, that resonated with me, being part of the diaspora also. But also, thinking about how the very basic step of interviewing and translating and just getting the word out of the existence of these movements in Iraq is actually a huge step because it's a little like Ahmed said in conversation, it's like hopefully kind of a spark or a candle, but in a really, really dark room. So that's what the hope is.
Ali, Against All Odds was recently launched here in New York City, and I understand that along with the book, there's a study and an organizational guide, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, recognizing that books are great, but not everybody has the time or also kind of the background to understand or access in a relevant way what the book contains, we thought to give like a little bit of background so that individuals, but especially organizations, can engage with it. So War Sisters League is very interested in popular education and the idea of kind of making an educational experience alive. So coming very soon will be a kind of accompanying study guide and then beginning steps to how you can actually begin to work in solidarity with the organizations featured in the book. And that'll be hopefully also a way to to broaden something from purely informational to kind of more interactive process, and we're excited about that coming soon.
Is there a website that people could go to or just generally about the War Resisters League?
In fact, yes. The website is warresisters.org, where you can find out of the book and our work against police militarization, which is one of our central campaigns. And then the co-publisher is called Tedween Publishing, and they there you can order the book online at tedweenpublishing.com.
Ali, how many U.S. military bases still remain in Iraq?
As far as I know, none, which is an important question because I think people aren't aware of the fact that they were basically dismantled in 2010 into 2012. And that was an important demand of this protest movement that I mentioned in 2011. In fact, an action on April 9th was called Occupying the Bases. So it was definitely so unpopular to maintain that U.S. presence in the form of military bases that even Maliki's government back in in the early 2010s couldn't maintain it at the U.S.'s request. So, that's I think another example of a small victory and an assertion of Iraqi demands there.
And something that very few Americans know.
That's right.
On a related note, what form does U.S. presence take on the ground?
I think that's it's a complex question because, in many ways, the withdrawal of late 2011 by the U.S. forces was not something desired by the U.S. and it really was a result of a lot of Iraqi conditions, popular demands, exhaustion by the U.S. military, and by the broad swaths of the U.S. public. But the U.S. is still an important player, of course, in Iraq, though that there are many competitors too, especially Iran and Saudi Arabia. So you could say that its regional ties, I think, are some of the most important ways that the U.S. projects its soft power and economic influence. And then the legacy of the occupation being a sectarian constitution, being the way to frame Iraq as a place that's, these sectarian enclaves, that's been its influence up to this day, and which has led to the disasters of, ISIS being able to take over parts of the country. So so it's a complex question, but I think once you ask it, you start to understand that Iraq has been opened up to many, many influences, and that the U.S. in some ways designed it like that, but has actually created something that's undermining its own influence because of the instability it's made there. Because the Iraqi demands for labor rights, for gender justice, are really in no one's interest in the region, including Iran, including the Gulf states, including the U.S., so that supporting these particular movements there is actually a pushback against the entire legacy of kind of like the weakening of the Iraqi state and it's opening up for all kinds of outside opportunism.
And we should mention that the foreword to Against All Odds is by Vijay Prashad, and it's wonderful, as is the book.
You know, one thing that struck me was the interview you did with the brother of the shoe thrower. Now, we all remember that from years ago when this Iraqi man threw a shoe at George W. Bush. Talk to us about the shoe-throwing incident and what the brother is doing in terms of organizing in Iraq.
Sure. So the shoe thrower, as he's known, is named Muntadhar Zaidi, and people might remember that he was a journalist who, during a press conference, one of Bush's last in Baghdad, he threw his shoes at him, saying that this was kind of like a message for some of the destruction that the U.S. occupation has caused.
And he served several years in prison for that, didn't he?
That's right, yeah. He was taken in, he was tortured, and then eventually left the country because of it.
But shoe throwing is something in the Iraq culture that is a really terrible, denigrating thing for the person who's on the other end of the shoe, right?
It's true, yeah. I mean, I kind of get the feeling, too, though, that in any society or situation, throwing shoes has that
right,
message attached
right.
to it. But shoes are negative. It's true. So that was a message. But what's really fascinating is that in 2011, as I mentioned before, there was this nascent protest movement across Iraq's various cities and regions. And one of the leaders emerging was Muntadhar's older brother, Oday, who, because of their name and their fame in Iraqi society, were able to kind of marshal that notoriety into a way to oppose, at the time, the Maliki government, the legacy of the U.S. occupation, and Iranian influence. So they were really kind of strategic about how that one moment had catalyzed the world's attention and wanted to marshal it to demand an end to sectarian constitution, more autonomy, more generally among various demands. So, the interview with him, and then kind of in the years following, Oday and Muntadhar's work continue, really show how more than an individual action, there's a way to kind of use these spectacular type moments to build something much more broad.
Ali, do you have a next project planned, a next book?
Well, not quite. I think my focus now is to try to take any attention that the book generates and really put it into building solidarity with the organizations in Iraq on the ground, because because once they're known, then we can do things such as work in joint campaigns with them, or an important group of leaders are part of the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions in Iraq, for example, and their website recently went down because there's not that kind of support. So there's just a lot of small things that would, I think, greatly improve their visibility and serve as an inspiration to people organizing here. And then maybe I can write a book about how that emerged someday.
I wanted to share with our listeners my remembrance of really one of the most shameful aspects of American history, and then ask you what your reaction to it was. Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of State under Clinton, appeared on CBS 60 Minutes and was interviewed by Leslie Stahl. And this was after the sanctions had been applied to Iraq in the early 1990s. And those sanctions killed an estimated 500,000 Iraqi children. And Leslie Stahl asked Madam Secretary, do you think it was worth it? Albright thought about it for a second and said, yes. 500,000 children. What was your reaction to that?
It's hard to know what to say, I guess, in the face of such, like, callousness. But maybe how I react to it, too, is to try to think about that's actually part of something much larger, you know, which is a general policy of harming the Iraqi people, its society, its infrastructure, for the sake of kind of a political and regional end, and understanding that that's how U.S. foreign policy is and how actually many regional powers operate. So Iraqis have been on the receiving end of this, kind of global game. And the one way to, I think, understand that in a constructive way is to see them as having opposed not just those policies, of course, but also Saddam's regime, because interestingly, some of the people in the book are affiliated with something called the Workers' Communist Party, which split off from the Iraqi Communist Party, so that it could oppose both U.S. policy and Saddam's regime at the same time. So I think, the massive numbers are sometimes mind-numbing, and bringing it back to friends I have there, things that they've said they're working on concretely, is one way to keep it manageable and able to kind of persevere.
That hope is still alive in Iraq, and that hope is brought out in your book, Against All Odds, is really quite extraordinary. And we're so grateful to you, Ali, for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
A very important contribution to the field. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.